You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, December 17th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, just back from Paris, France, having reported on the climate accords in Paris, Grist reporter Ben Adler will tell us about what some are hailing as the most important international agreement signed in generations. Meanwhile, such a sad Christmas story. His first name, Martin? Martin Shkreli. Shkreli.
Shkreli.
Shkreli.
Make it easy on yourself.
Martin Shkreli. The man who would have price gouge those who are desperately needing medication, arrested for securities fraud. Oh, how could they do this time of year, too? Meanwhile, speaking of this time of year, the war on Christmas rages on. Charlie Brown terrorized. And according to Bill O'Reilly, and as long as we're talking about terrorism, Enrique Marquez, the neighbor and longtime childhood friend of the man who murdered 14 people, or at least some of them, in the terrorist attack in San Bernardino, is going to be charged for supplying them the guns. Begging them the question, why would you arrest someone who supplied them guns? Guns don't kill people. People kill people. Very strange. Meanwhile, more details on the budget deal scheduled to be voted upon any moment. It appears that Chicago teachers are headed for another strike in the new year. We'll give you an update on that. Vladimir Putin praises Donald Trump for his flamboyance and well-spokenness. Did Ted Cruz expose classified material during the debate? That's what the chair of the Intelligence Committee wants to know. Sheldon Adelson's family buys Nevada's largest newspaper. Sheldon Adelson pretends it wasn't him. And Flint, Michigan has poisoned its own children. Yes, happy days are here again, ladies and gentlemen. We will get to all of these stories and more. Did you want to say something, Michael?
Did you see the Harry's?
Yes. Okay, no, that great. I know.
Oh no.
Yes.
No, no. I had a Putin thing, but the time has passed.
Okay.
Get to that later.
Well, we'll get back to Putin later. It's just I don't know. I mean, I wonder. It's going to be fun to see if Trump brags about how much Putin likes
he
him.
Hasn't already.
He respects me. He respects me. We see eye to eye. I love Putin. But he's just
stablemate. Right.
I love Putin. Putin loves me, but he's crafty. Not as crafty and shifty as the Chinese, of course.
Jeb Bush is a low energy man.
that would be really funny, actually, to see that. Just a reminder, folks, this program relies on your membership to be possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We will have tomorrow on the program joining us for our year-end review. One of a couple we'll do will actually be the Uber blogger, Digby, Heather Parton, who also writes for Salon.com. We'll have Cliff next week on next Tuesday. But tomorrow we will also hear from Isabel and film guy Matthew, who will give us their year-end film deals. And I can already see how excited Kelly is that Isabel will be on. So still freaking out from the fact that she was, that Isabel was that guy's wife on that show. Folks, as you can see, or maybe you can't see, I am unshaven at the moment. However, between now and the time that I appear on MSNBC at the 6 p.m. show, I don't even know who hosts it. It's going to be a different show soon, but I'm going to be on it tonight. I will be clean shaven. And how will I be clean shaven? Will I go through that difficult process with crappy blades that from some plastic container that I've gotten at Walgreens for like $78? I don't know how much they're selling those things now, but it's like literally like you're buying the Pink Panther when you get one of these things. It's like shrouded in like museum grade protection. I don't know if that's because they're afraid people are going to steal them or what. I have no idea why they do that, but it's incredibly annoying. And why is that? Because I get my shaving blades for about half the price that you pay for one of those big branded blades, and they are shipped directly to my home. They're better, too. Why pay $32 for a pack of 8 blades? It's half the price at Harry's. And with Harry's, you get a better shave. Show some respect to your skin, your face. I don't know, your arms, if you shave your arms or your legs. The starter set is an amazing deal. You get, for $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shaving cream, and 3 razor blades. And if you've never gotten Harry's before, you use the coupon code Majority Report, you get $5 off that amazing deal. Men, women, ladies, gentlemen, we all need razors that shave well and don't suck. Go to harrys.com now. Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code Majority Report with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter coupon code Majority Report at the checkout for $5 off. Start shaving better today. Also, don't forget, makes an amazing gift, a really great gift. It's not like a crappy looking blade that you know, handle. It's a nice, like, well, you get to pick out which one you want, but it's a nice chrome one is the one that I like.
Nice.
Yeah. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ben Adler from Grist on this deal that's taking place in Paris. And I'll also ask him about a little bit of one provision in this budget deal, if that doesn't drive him crazy, which, you know, it, I imagine it will drive him crazy, and also not great for the planet.
Dude, stripping in Times Square. He's freaking out so much over that budget provision.
I'm not sure
crazy.
You're adding things up properly. All right, folks, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program. He is a writer for grist.org and just back from Paris. Ben Adler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ben, let's just set the context before, obviously, you were in Paris, you're reporting on this agreement. Before we actually speak about the agreement itself, set the context. How did we end up getting to Paris? And compare and contrast, if you will, Kyoto, which, as far as I can tell, was sort of the last model for something like what we saw in Paris this week.
Right. So in 1992, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was negotiated and signed. That's the treaty that set up this framework under which countries come together once a year to discuss modifications and updates. An important point here is that those modifications and updates, which the Paris Agreement is a big collection of, are not treaties in themselves and do not require Senate ratification. Kyoto was the sort of first big effort to actually bring countries together with binding emissions target reductions. Now, under U.S. law, if the U.S. is going to enter into a treaty with binding or an agreement with binding emissions cuts, that crosses the threshold into being a treaty and requires Senate ratification. And the Senate, of course, did not ratify Kyoto, nor did the U.S. or most countries that had agreed to greenhouse gas emissions reductions under Kyoto meet those promises. So Kyoto was something of a failure. It also only required developed countries to cut their emissions, which made a lot more sense in 1997 than it would today, with the explosive growth of economic activity, population, and emissions in China in particular, but also other countries in Latin America and Asia. So the reason the Paris Agreement is a big step forward is that all 196 countries agreed to that it is all of their responsibility to combat climate change. Everyone has a responsibility to limit emissions and ultimately move away from fossil fuels. Or actually, in the language of the agreement, decarbonize. Decarbonize the language activists wanted. Net zero carbon emissions is what the goal is laid out. So in theory, you could also achieve that through some technology that's
so carbon decarbonize as opposed to net net zero emissions. What is the difference there?
So the more progressive environmental activists and sort of human rights activists, indigenous groups would prefer language that called for decarbonizing or getting rid of fossil fuels, because they don't just want to stop climate change from getting worse. They also want to get away from extracting fossil fuels out of the ground, which has other environmental and economic and social negative consequences. Other countries and there are a lot of countries that would have been happy to agree to that, right? And say, we're going to be powered by, we want the world economy to be powered by entirely renewable energy by the end of the century or something like that. But then you have countries like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, that draw heavily, you know, economically from extracting oil and selling it. And their argument is, in terms of climate change, it's not really, who cares about oil per se, it's just the net increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that causes warming that we are concerned about. So we could just solve this problem, hopefully, maybe by, you know, planting enough trees to suck up all the carbon dioxide.
Okay.
So let's just say net carbon and zero. And that's what they ended up having to. The thing about the language here is it's passed unanimously. So you have to come up with things that keep everyone sufficiently happy to stay on board.
Do we have that? I mean, and I can understand their argument. Like, your problem isn't with fossil fuels per se. Your problem is what the implications of burning those fossil fuels are. And if we can just solve that, the implications, then we're fine from the perspective of Saudi Arabia or Texas or North Dakota, let's say.
Right.
But do we really have that capacity? I mean, it's one thing
no.
to say like, well, wow, we actually have a plan right here where you know, but there isn't. I mean, that's part of the problem, right? Is that like that part about where you can deal with the implications of burning fossil fuel and not have to worry about fossil fuel per se. That's
right.
Because it's sort of a myth, right? I mean, that's like clean coal.
Yeah, exactly. The problem is that the technology to suck carbon out of the air, safely transport it to somewhere you can store it permanently underground, permanently, that's a never come out, right? And do that in a way that is cheaper than just switching to solar and wind and hydro, or just like, you know, being more efficient and using less energy. It just hasn't happened, and it probably won't. The other thing is, and if it does, great. I mean, the thing is, in a weird way, it's like they're both right.
Right.
I mean, part of what the Paris Agreement is going to do is encourage countries to come up with ways of stopping deforestation and hopefully promoting reforestation, because trees are carbon sinks. Now, that's great, right? I mean, trees are good for a whole bunch of reasons, and it's totally valid to say we are going to realistically be using some fossil fuels for the time being, and so we should offset their carbon emissions as much as possible by improving the cover of trees and grasslands and other carbon sinks. But ultimately, there's only so much fossil fuels in the world. And ultimately, we can't have a global economy powered by these finite resources. We need renewable resources, or else we're going to see eventually prices spike. We're going to see conflicts over the, you know, access to those resources. I mean, I'm saying this like it's a future thing. We already
right.
see this. That's
of
why
course.
We have all these troops in the Middle East, in part, right? So clearly, we do need to move away from fossil fuels ultimately. And the other thing is, and again, like, this comes down to a matter of perspective. Everyone, no matter how much they don't really care about the environment, with the exception of the Republican Party, every major party or government in the world accepts the fact that climate change is happening. It's going to be bad. It's going to be, no matter how callous you are about the human suffering, it's going to cause economic damage. So we have to address that. But then a lot of people, and I'm openly in this camp myself, think that like conventional pollutants that cause asthma and people to cough and choke. You look at the smog in Beijing or Delhi or sometimes even L.A. is a bad thing too, right? And so burning oil and coal and ruining areas where we extract those things, oil spills and all these things are also bad, and we'd be better off getting away from them.
So you're one of those people who don't think that having asthma builds character. Is that what you're saying?
No, I have a disagreement with the Koch brothers about this.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, fair enough. But wait, you know, I want to, you know, it's weird. But as you say to me, like this idea that the Republican Party is literally the only major political party in the world that refutes the idea of climate change and it being man-made. Is that, I mean, I don't know that I've ever really sort of like concentrated on that concept. You know, I sort of glibly may have said that myself, but is that actually the case? I mean, is there literally?
Yes, it is. I mean,
in terms of government in the world,
there's 196 governments. I was just in Paris. There are 196 governments there. I watched the heads of state speak. They accept climate science. That doesn't mean they're all nice progressives.
They're like North Korea,
right? Vladimir Putin,
right? North Korea.
Right. Yeah.
North Korea is fighting
North
climate
Korea
change.
North Korea totally accepts, yeah, they accept climate science. And in fact, I just saw a story the other day that they might try and work on some partnerships with South Korea on some of this. But like, let's take Vladimir Putin, who has generally been one of the worst and is in a sense a very right-wing figure.
Right.
And in fact, sort of, you know, the Republicans in this weird way, they sort of have this crush on him because he's such a manly man. And,
he's very manly.
You know,
I mean, let's be honest.
He acts, and Russia, by the way, also has a ton of gas and oil, right? And it's really essential to their economy, and Putin, like, pillages, he's, you know, steals the wealth for himself, and he's got a lot of reasons to deny climate science, and in the past, sort of has, but he has shifted to fully accepting climate science. He made a speech in which he calls it the greatest threat to human existence or something in Paris. Now, Russia still has lousy policies on climate change relative to other developed countries, but he doesn't deny the empirical fact that the Earth is getting warmer and is causing things like glaciers melting. And he doesn't deny the overwhelming scientific consensus that is caused by greenhouse gas emissions.
I mean,
no government in the world does.
It's so stunning to think of that. I mean, somebody should be making a video right now of 191 heads of states around the world just acknowledging the existence of climate science. And then, you know, once you get through every tiny little, country or places that we perceive
right.
as being completely backward, and, you know, and then we just get to the House of Representatives in the United States and, the U.S. Senate and get to the Republicans. All right. So that's the backdrop. And so we go into this, we go into Paris and give us a sense of, I mean, my sort of like broadly speaking, my sense is that activists and environmentalists and people in the know of this stuff and policy experts, and I guess really, you know, everybody who agrees in climate change, so the entire world except for a major political party of this country, perceive these talks and this agreement as sort of being akin to, and you tell me if this metaphor makes sense, we've agreed that the house may be on fire. We've agreed to build the fire station. We have ordered the parts for the fire trucks. We're just not going to send them out quite yet.
And, yeah. That's a good analogy.
And it's there so that when things get really, really bad, we've at least got the mechanism to fight the fire. Is that like a fair assessment, broadly speaking, for a layperson?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it's exactly right about sort of about the part that we built the framework that could allow. The reason some people would say this is a huge success is because we finally established a framework in which every country in the world shares responsibility for reducing emissions and averting catastrophic climate change. And if the countries, what we haven't agreed to is making the kinds of cut. No one has agreed to making the kinds of cuts necessary to actually get there, though. And so the question is, but the big success I actually think your analogy really holds up well, because the big success in the agreement is that, which we were unsure of coming in, was that we got everyone to agree that the pledges that countries made for emissions cuts go from 2020 to 2030. We are going to need bigger emissions cuts in that decade, not just after it, if we're going to stay below 2 degrees Celsius of warming over pre-industrial levels. So the big success was we got everyone to agree to come back in 2020 and hopefully pledge then bigger cuts between 2025 and 2030, and then come back every 5 years thereafter and keep strengthening the emissions cuts. And if you were to ask, well, why would they come back with stronger emissions cuts in 5 years? There's one aspect of it that you sort of left out, which is that once we begin down that path, we'll find hopefully that it's easier and countries are, and everyone trusts that everyone else is playing along. But the other thing, which is I think the part that you were referring to, is climate change keeps getting worse.
Right.
So people will have a sense of urgency in 5 years after there's been more, like another Hurricane Sandy type event.
Right.
In your country, then you will be more willing to do more about it. You'll have more political will in your country to do it, or just more of a sense of urgency in your own self-interest. So that's the hope. And that's the process that's been set up. Of course, if the Republican Party wins the presidential election next year, then they're not very likely to come back in 2020 and say, yeah, the U.S. is going to make bigger cuts. And the U.S., being the world's largest economy, is currently the second largest emitter, and historically the largest emitter by far, cumulatively, it's really important that the U.S. does its fair share and makes the biggest cuts. And so if President Cruz is in the White House in 2020, that's going to be a major stumbling block.
But I mean, the upside is we'll have defeated the war on PC. So that we will have that going for us. All right. But so we've gone over, this notion of the ratchet mechanism, right? That is the coming yes. back every 5 years, the sort of like, you know, it's basically to belabor my analogy. We've built the firehouse. We're going to come back in 5 years, just see how much of the town is burnt down at that point. And maybe we'll send the fire trucks out. The other thing in your reporting, you've written is, developed countries or richer developing countries have started to contribute to climate finance. So that's countries that maybe at the time of the Kyoto Accords didn't have the resources and hadn't moved along in their economies to be able to contribute to this fight. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, exactly. So if you look back at GDP per capita in the 1990s for countries like China or South Korea or Singapore, it was much, much lower than it was anywhere in like Europe or, you know, the U.S. So they were simply put in the same category of developing countries that received climate finance rather than contributing it. But now, South Korea, for example, is richer than a lot of countries in Eastern Europe. And it just doesn't make sense to leave it in the same category as countries in like sub-Saharan Africa. Or South Asian countries that are just, you know, much, much less money. So, but the thing is, those countries were really resistant to being formally moved into a new category of developed countries that are now on the hook. And so instead they settled on this compromise language of developed countries have this responsibility to donate to climate finance, and other countries that are willing and able to do so, or something to that effect. There's actually something to be said for that, because it also leaves open the possibility of, you know, countries, their circumstances evolve, and other countries, unforeseen countries, may in 5 or 10 years be rich enough to start contributing to climate finance as well. And we want everyone to pitch in. So
if I hear what you're saying,
that's a huge issue.
Instead of having making it a category change, you basically open up all categories of these countries to sort of have some measure of responsibility. There's a little wiggle room there. Let me ask you this. I mean, just so that people get a notion of just sort of how astounding it is to get 191 countries to agree to something like this. You know, even if people perceive this as anemic, at least in the short term, in terms of actual execution of agendas and ambition of agendas, you know, putting aside the sort of the mechanisms that are built. If I'm a country that I don't want to be reclassified. I don't want to be recategorized, because it changes my responsibilities and my obligations. It puts more of an onus on me. But also, how much of what happens here impacts other arenas? So in other words, if I'm categorized as a mid-developing country, let's say, in the Paris Accords, how much does that impact me for other obligations and other treaties, or potentially impact me as a country in other obligations and other treaties that could come down the road? In other words, like, oh, you've been classified as a mid-developing country here. That means we're going to get rid of $100 billion worth of food aid that you get, or something like that. Is that an issue in these things?
No. So here's the deal. The classification within the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change I don't think they were concerned that that would necessarily have any impact on any other issue outside of climate change, like other UN agreements or policies. What I think they were concerned about is what it would obligate them to in 5 years from now, right, and 10 years from now and so forth under this particular framework. In other words, they just don't want to be reclassified as richer developing nations or now developed or whatever for future, just within this particular issue of climate change. Because the thing you have to understand is that there's going to be, in decades to come, and this is just, you just see this beginning to bubble up, huge issues of the demands made by poor countries on rich countries to compensate them for, help them prepare for the effects of climate change. Because rich countries have used up all the carbon budget. They've right. burned all these fossil fuels that have caused this 1 degree Celsius of warming we've already experienced. They've gotten rich doing so. And now the developing countries can't do that, or else they'll be screwing themselves over because they'll be flooding themselves out of their homes in Bangladesh and in Fiji and all over these tropical regions that are generally more climate vulnerable than the U.S. and Japan and Europe. So they want money from us, as well they should, right? And they're going to be, it might ultimately end up in courts that they're going to file suits against fossil fuel companies or against rich countries saying, you owe us for the damage that's being caused. Right now, it's not getting to that point. They're just trying to work into these agreements money for building renewable energy economies in developing countries, money for climate adaptation, meaning build seawalls and all that kind of stuff. They also, though this is a new issue, they want something called loss and damage. And that's like when Typhoon Haiyan hits the Philippines and there's massive suffering and loss, you can't say that typhoon was caused by climate change, but you can say the Philippines are suffering more frequent and severe typhoons because of climate change. Well, shouldn't the countries that got rich causing climate change pony up? That's their position. And so if you're China or South Korea, and you've only in the last decade or two started emitting a lot, you don't want to be moved into this category where you're going to be on the hook mm-hmm. the same way that the U.S., which has been emitting, the biggest per capita emitter in the world for 150 years is. And China's position there, I think, is understandable. And it wouldn't really be fair to them to put them on the hook the same amount that we are. That's so you have you need this more fluidity of definitions. Because you still can say, hey, China, come up with $3 billion, as they did, for clean energy finance, because you have a stake in avoiding climate change, reducing climate change and helping
And you've received, that's commensurate with the benefit that you have received from basically externalizing the costs of your economic growth, right? I mean, this is all about externalities, and we're just doing it on a different level. And you're going to have to now pay for that externality that you basically imposed on the planet. The U.S. has imposed more of those external costs. China, maybe less so, et cetera. Okay, I get that. Now, let me ask you this. What are the mechanisms to get that money? It seems to me there are three different ways you do it. One is this is only fair, and we're just appealing to your better angels. Indonesia to China to America, let's say. Or B, you're going to cause so much social instability that this is going to come back on you. I mean, you've seen what happened in Syria. Mm-hmm. You've seen what if we have a massive drought in Northern Africa. I'm pulling this out of my out of the air. But if we have a massive drought in Northern Africa, we're going to cause instability that may leak into the Middle East or whatever it is. So you got to pay us to basically maintain some type of social equilibrium. And then the third one is a legal apparatus, sort of almost like, you know, this is a tort court, and we're going to take you to court, and we're going to sue you because we can prove damages. And, you know, this is there's a case, you know, this is a case like you were a factory housing bad chemicals, and you didn't want to spend the money on a proper factory, and it leaked into our river, and you're going to pay now to clean that river and to, you know, help all the people who got sick from it. Is there an apparatus in the Paris Accords or in anywhere else? Is it via the UN, or is there just sort of basic where that type of lawsuit takes place?
Oh, right. So in the Paris, in the Paris agreements, the developing nations and their sort of, you know, civil society, non-governmental organizations like Oxfam, let's say, that work, you know, on global poverty issues, simply made the argument to rich countries that they should contribute to climate finance for the first two reasons that you mentioned. Moral obligation, and it's ultimately in their own interest to avoid like massive waves of refugees, and things like that. The third point is just starting to emerge, and there's nothing in the Paris Agreement about it. In fact, loss and damage, so loss and damage has never been included before, and the U.S. And EU were completely adamant that they would not sign an agreement that said anything about liability or compensation from rich countries to poor countries for climate change. The loss and damage phrasing that they got in said something like, basically, we're going to set up a working group to figure out how can we minimize or help people in places suffering loss and damage.
Does that include coming up with a formula to compensate, or is it?
No. It explicitly said no liability. This doesn't imply any liability.
We're setting up a charity, basically.
Yeah, it tried to sort of leave out as much as possible even the notion of really like handing over money. It's more like we'll set up a a UN, sort of like a little agency or something that does things like lends technical assistance to countries where, like, you know, sort of how do you deal with people getting flooded out of their homes? You know, like, right. How do you, like, physically move the town? And, you know, like, so all of which is fine, but none of which I think is going to, 20 years from now,
be sufficient.
When climate change has gotten worse, keep these people satisfied, right? So ultimately, there's going to have to be some redistribution there. And the question is, as you point out, how do the poor countries that have less power make the rich countries do it? And there isn't, I'm not an expert on sort of international tort law kind of questions, and I don't know what international courts you could bring a tort in, like saying, like, it's basically the same as if you dumped, you know, the chemicals from your factory in my backyard, but that is, of course, what it's like. What they can do, though, is bring suits in their own countries. So, for example, in the Philippines right now, there's a case that's just begun against all the largest fossil fuel companies that have any operations in the Philippines, thus making them subject to lawsuits in the Philippines, and they're being sued for climate change. Now, the question, of course, will be if the courts in the Philippines say, you know what, this is a good point. You know, we got all these poor people in these low-lying regions getting screwed over by climate change, and ExxonMobil ought to reimburse them. Well, what is ExxonMobil going to do? Are they going to hand over the money? No, right? I mean, right. I don't know what they'll do, but they're going to fight back. They're not going to just accept those rulings necessarily. So I don't know how, you know, only time will tell how all of this ends up getting sorted out.
Lastly, let me just, I mean, that's fascinating because, you know, obviously you're building a, you're building some type of, I don't know if it's case law per se, but you're building, you know, because one country does it, you know, certainly it is not uncommon for, you know, particularly Supreme Courts of one country to sort of cite what is happening in other countries in terms of particularly
right.
these sort of broad concepts of liability. Let me just ask you in closing, because, you know, as I've been reading about this stuff and talking to people about it, you know, the interesting thing here is that there's this amazing paradox where those countries that have contributed least to the problem that we have tend to be those countries that are most sensitive to the problems that have been created. And the inverse of that is a country like the United States, which has created the problem in many respects. I'm not saying this was our plan. I don't want any of our right winger friends to get upset. I'm not in any way denying our exceptionalism, that the same mechanism by which we created this problem and all of the benefits that accrued as we created this problem are the same things that are impediments to our recognizing the problem. So, in other words, we have the superstorm Sandy is not necessarily a function of climate change. It could be, it may not be, but what is clearly a function of climate change is the extra foot of water in New York Harbor that
right.
ends up flooding large parts of New York City. But, you know, 4 weeks later, it's not really, you know, it's certainly not the country's problem, and it's barely the city's problem. There are individual parts of the city, but the city's functioning normally at that point because we have the money and the resources to sort of absorb these problems. But if this happens in a, I don't know, in a low-lying island in the Philippines, then this, you know, destroys the lives of tens upon thousands of people for years to come. And so there's this sort of paradox, isn't there, that is one of the largest impediments to actual real sort of aggressive action.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, what makes it all the more paradoxical is this. Take a country like India. India is very climate vulnerable, right? Extreme heat is a problem in India. You have the floods in Chennai that were going on while we were in Paris that are, you know, caused by huge rains that are flooding people out of their home. And India is a poor country that doesn't have the means to deal with it the way we do in the U.S. So on the one hand, they are an example of the countries that, and while they emit a lot because they have so many people, their emissions per capita are very small. So they're an example of what you're talking about, like in the Philippines, a country that is, you know, getting the brunt of the damage that has been caused by countries like the U.S. But on the other hand, India has 300 million people without electricity. And so India, and it has coal. So India is not only in the position of getting the brunt of damage caused by countries like the U.S., it also has a stronger incentive than the U.S. to say, yeah, we don't like climate change, but on the other hand, we need to give our people electricity, and we need to do it as cheaply as possible. And so you have countries like India saying, we're not going to sign on to as strong an agreement as you want on climate change. We're not going to agree to cut our own emissions. You want to cut yours? Great, you should. Because you've caused the problem up to this point. But you can't come to us now and say, hey, India, because you have 1.25 billion people, you just can't emit anything like we did, and you're going to have to stay impoverished. That's crazy, you know, because there's many different kinds of suffering. It's not like climate change is the only kind, right?
Right.
Those people living without electricity are suffering right now, too. So what
They're basically in a pick your poison type of situation, right? It's either we can have large catastrophes that we deal with, or we can just have a slow burn of you know, disease and poverty.
Grinding poverty, yeah. But so here's the thing. We can buy our way out of this problem if we just were generous enough. The problem is the U.S. and other rich countries won't buy off India and countries like that. Indonesia is another good example. We need to go to India and Indonesia and say, we know you have the potential to rapidly develop economically. Of course, you have the right to, and you should, but you need to do it entirely on clean energy. And yes, it might be more expensive in some cases right now than
fossil
fuels.
But we'll subsidize it.
Exactly. And if we came up with enough money, they would, because they're terrified of climate change. It's
sure.
not like, they're not Republicans. They're not denying that it's going to happen. They just have competing priorities, and we need to just buy them off. And we could, but we won't come up with the money. And that's why the agreement isn't as strong as it needed to be, because we aren't buying off India and getting them to commit to those emissions reductions, because we're offering a tiny amount. We're a couple billion dollars over 5 years. We need to offer them many times that amount to get what we need from them.
Well, Ben, we have wars to fight, so we can't be willy-nilly with our money. And so it's fascinating stuff, Ben. I appreciate your the reporting you did on the talks themselves, but also sort of your insights in this issue and a larger perspective on it. Ben Adler, we will link to your pieces on at grist.org. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Sorry about those earlier technical difficulties. Of course, if you're listening on the podcast, you won't hear any of them. It's your membership that makes it possible for us to buy new computers when the computer, for some reason, decides, like, oh, I'm not going to emit sound right now for some reason. Or when we buy... I don't know, getting another horrible something. So this is weird. And also, folks, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Makes a great gift as well. And buy the Majority Report blend. It's a medium roast, I believe, and it's a mixed beans. Enjoyed. The country over. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. All you got to do is go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the link, bookmark it. If you buy crap from Amazon, just always buy it through that bookmarked link. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM us through the app. We'll be right back.